We all have a story to tell. Our lives are unique and fascinating. Struck with loss and tragedy, bound by affection and love. I'm Suzanne Lang, and this is A Novel Idea. Today we feature two books about people's lives told in their own words, with a little help, nudging, and support from the two women we talk with today. In just a minute, we talk with Suzanne Sherman, author and publisher of 100 Years in the Life of an American Girl. And Suzanne will be soon appearing at Gaia's Garden in Santa Rosa as part of their regular Dining with Authors series. Later in the broadcast, we'll talk with Laura McHale Holland, editor of the anthology Sister Born, Sisters Found, a diversity of voices on sisterhood. So stay with us. It's KRCB's A Novel Idea. In the past 100 years, we've gone from poor sanitation and riding horses to genetic engineering and riding in Teslas. Longtime Bay Area book and magazine editor Suzanne Sherman has just released 100 Years in the Life of an American Girl, stories about being a girl over the past century. Suzanne has taught the craft of memoir to hundreds of people and over time found she had a wealth of material revealing the social and cultural currents that have carried us to where we are now. She is the author of Lesbian and Gay Marriage, Private Commitments, Public Ceremonies. Here's my conversation with Suzanne Sherman. 100 years of life of an American girl is what we're here to talk about today. But before we get into the specifics of that book, I would like our listeners to know a little bit about you. You seem to have a history of storytelling and of memoir. And I'd like to start there, your fascination with that as a form of expression.
Yes, I would say it all started very long ago. I'm in my mid-50s now, and for me, my interest in the stories of our lives and the telling and sharing of those stories started a long time ago. But it really started in a private way where I started keeping a diary that grew into a much longer journal over the years, and all of that began at about age 10. By the time I was in my teenage years, I switched over to a three-ring notebook so I could keep adding papers to it and just tell all the things that were going on and describe them in detail. But in later years, when I was in my mid-30s, I decided to shift what I was doing. I'd worked as an editor for over 10 years by then, and I decided it was time to get out of the cubicle and, you know, get with the people and stop only editing, but get involved with helping people tell the stories of their lives. And so I started teaching memoir writing, and I had just moved to the Santa Rosa area. I lived in Sebastopol, and I started working for Santa Rosa Junior College as adjunct faculty in memoir, and before long ended up with 4 classes per week, which I did for almost 20 years in addition to other things, editing.
So what is it about the memoir that you feel is such a vital form for people to explore?
I think memoir is so important for so many reasons. One of the first reasons is really for the writer's self, to do the writing, to do the kind of exploration of experience that only comes in the privacy of time that you have when you're writing. It's so different from being in conversation with someone where you're organizing your thoughts and you're speaking on subjects that are only related to, you know, only makes sense for the conversation that you're having with the person you're having it with. But when you're writing, you're in your private time, you're writing for yourself. That's a very important conversation to have, I believe. The experience that you get from it is partly you get to understand better what's gone on in your life, and also you get to savor good times that have happened. And partly what you're doing, as I said, is for yourself, and part of it also is a communication to others. So it's a pretty significant way, and different from any other way, of communicating your experience with people that you care about, and probably also people that you don't yet know that will follow you. So it's an important chronicling of the times of your life.
So have you found that with social media and the immediacy of us self-chronicling our own lives, is that different from memoir, or is it an offshoot or an affectation, or what do you think of all that?
Well, that's an interesting question. I've never put those two together, social media and memoir, but there is a relationship because there is an interest in sharing the stories of our lives, sharing the Snapchat photos, which my young niece is busy doing all the time, the moment here and moment there that just happened, and that photo that only lasts just a moment. So that's not even writing. But the short bits that people are putting up on social media about their experiences does show to me an interest in sharing and communicating with other people, and in a way that they can or cannot relate to, but just says, you know, this is what I'm doing. Hello. And have a look at my life for a minute.
And as you said, it seems like a memoir is really an opportunity for self-examination and reflection.
I believe it really is. And that's what you do not have in social media. Social media is more about connecting. It's about having relationships in a certain way with people, but it's not at all the same as what happens with memoir, which is, I would say, more about just sharing the depths of your experience, and that can't be done in social media. It's not wanted there. There's not room for it, or it's not the audience, and it's not the platform for it.
So you found yourself teaching others this form of work, of writing, and that seems to be what led you directly into this large project of 100 years in the life.
Yes.
And it seems, this is my understanding, that 100 years in the life of an American girl is just a facet of
yes.
this larger picture. So why don't you talk about that?
Yes, thank you. 100 years in the life of an American girl is the first book in a series that I'm planning, and I've chosen to do this series on 100 years in the life. So the next book in that series will be, it's going to explore, I'm exploring the three different major age phases in a woman's life. So that's girlhood, teenagehood, and adulthood or womanhood. So, and from there, I would go on if all goes well. I'm very excited about the idea of 100 years in the life of a romance and having parlor romances of the 20s all the way through transgender marriages in the new millennium, anything else that happens in between. There's just a lot of potential for subjects with 100 years in a life. And I chose to start with the three stages of womanhood, or, you know, because I have had so many students over the years. And I haven't only taught for Santa Rosa Junior College. I've taught for other colleges and a number of different programs and privately, online, et cetera. So I've dealt with a lot of different people. And I would say that the majority of them are female. Not, you know, I've had a number of male students as well, and that's been wonderful. But I've heard more stories from female students, and I've heard so many stories about times that never could have touched my life. I was born right at the end of the 50s and really grew up in the 60s. So I heard stories when I started teaching back in the mid-90s. My eldest students were in their later 80s, and childhoods were in the 10s. People were born in 1907, 1908. I was hearing stories like one that's in the book about a door-to-door car salesman that her father purchased his first car from, right. And she had her first car ride in. And I was hearing all these amazing stories of life, riding to school on horseback and experiencing water coming out of a faucet when she moved to town, or turning a light on with a string hanging from the ceiling. I mean, these were such thrilling times that people were writing about, and hard times that people were writing about, up through the 10s, 20s, 30s, into the 50s and 60s.
And firsthand stories.
So I was hearing so many of them and helping. I was like a story midwife, helping people bring these stories into the world and bringing my background as a writer and an editor and helping draw the stories out, helping people shape their stories and learn how to use some of the good details of memoir craft to really bring the stories of their lives to life and help others understand what it was like. And then as time went on and I kept on doing those particular classes, my students were passing away and other students joining my classes were younger. So now these people who had been born in 1907 and 1910, et cetera, were passing on, and their stories were leaving. And that really struck me more and more as the years went on, that I was such a lucky person to hear about the thrill. You can read in any textbook or hear in a class about somewhere about electricity or any of the factual things that happen, but there's nothing like the real deal coming right from the person with their words and their particular specific memories. And then there are also the stuff that aren't even on the books that you'll never even guess, and they've ended up, between the covers of my book, 100 Years in the Life of an American Girl. So I'm very excited about that.
So how did you begin curating the pieces that appeared in the book?
Well, I started by opening the files that I had titled Keepers, that I had collected over the years that people had given me. And I read through looking for stories of girlhood and then contacted families and got permission to use the stories. And then those were for the early stories. Most of them were stories I already had been given. And then when I got to the 1940s and upwards from there, it was a combination of interview by phone, interview in person, and collecting written submissions from people who had writing experience. As the girls got younger through the 80s, 90s, and 2000s, I would say that most, if not all, of those stories came to me by interview. So we would be collecting the interview, and I'd be writing their words as they said them. Working with that, then I put my own voice in as the narrator, sort of like an old Greek chorus, where I would step in and move the story along or connect what would have been really fragmented if I hadn't done that. So that's how those stories came to me and how I'll do it for future books as well.
So this is spanning 100 years, and what surprised me was the number of people and before I get into what surprised me, I want to say that I could hear the voice of the little girl or the young woman talking. And I wonder if that was something that when you're teaching memoir, is that a technique for kind of identifying with that aspect of your own life rather than the, you know, 75-year-old reflecting back, but more, say, the 10-year-old writing from that 10-year-old voice and position. Is that a technique that's used in memoir writing?
Yes, absolutely. I want something that I teach my students early on is to let go of using the words "I remember," that everything that's being written is remembered. All of it is a reflection and a memory. And so it's much more engaging for a reader to be taken there. It's when we open a book and we fall in, you know, when we just get so immediately engaged. It's not because someone has started a paragraph saying, "I remember when." That's like it was a dark and stormy night. It's just too expected. It's too predictable. It's not interesting. But when we get drawn directly into a scene, into someone's experience, in their voice and feel spoken to, we not only are more engaged as a reader, so a writer is doing a better job of reaching the people that they are writing for or sharing it with eventually, but we are also really showing what it was like. It's much truer to what it was like. So the first time out when people are writing, they have a tendency to say, "I remember when," but it's that cleaning up for the second draft, the polishing after you have it on paper, that you would look through and cross those things out, take them out, and get to the story. Mm-hmm.
Well, now we'll get to what surprised me. that from the earliest stories, which were, you know, really the turn of the last century, that so many of the young girls experienced broken homes all through the Hundred Years. You know, I think this is maybe reveals something about the nature of marriage and family that perhaps we think is a kind of newish phenomenon, but really it's not, and that this is something children have had to deal with for a very long time.
Right. It was surprising to me as well to learn about some of that, and I certainly saw divorce and separation and step families and different shapes of families happening with greater frequency in, I would say, the last 40 years, probably from the 1970s forward. And I did not, in seeking the girls and women to collect stories from for the book, I did not ask for anything in particular. I was only looking, really, what I had in mind was diversity of region and diversity of, well, racial background, so I could have a mix, and I did get both of those things. So the frequency of divorce and various things happening in families like that, that was just by chance. And so it kind of showed me maybe even more how common it was. And then you can see with the girls in Chapter 10, which is the 2000s chapter, how they're just mentioning it like, it's nothing. It's just part of, oh, is that, that's, you know, it's just referred to, I stayed over at my friend's stepdad's house or my, and then in the 70s when it was starting to happen with more frequency, divorce was, seemed to be more of an issue in girls' lives. They wanted to speak a little bit about it and didn't really see that happen in later years. In earlier parts of the century, there were also those divorces, like in the 1940s, one of the girls in Chapter 4 had a father who had divorced her mother, and her mom went to work at a parachute factory, and her dad goes off to war, and she was a 5-year-old. So just experiencing the different things happening in that time and under the circumstances of the bigger world events, that was happening. It's interesting.
One thing I noticed, too, is that technology is something that they talked about in certain ways, and it's real easy to see that transition in how technology is so important just in day-to-day living, whether it was, as you mentioned, the door-to-door salesman selling cars, or in the later chapters, girls saving up money to buy their iPods. And that was an interesting thread through the whole book. And I think I should mention that the book is structured per decade, so that there are several young girls talking about their lives per decade and ending in 2010. And something else I noticed that was a common thread was the whole thing of language and immigration, and that there are often generations or parents that did not speak English, but for the young girl, she may be speaking more than one language just as they're assimilating. And I thought that that was something interesting, too, that that is a constant throughout the past 100 years.
Right. So in the early part of the 20th century, when so many people were coming, so many immigrants were coming from so many different parts of Europe and Eastern Europe and Ireland, et cetera, one of the, I have to call her a girl, even though she was a woman later when I knew her, but one of the girls' stories in Chapter 2, which is the 1920s, was one of those daughters of immigrants. And the things that were happening in the world at that time were different and similar, because sometimes it was because of war. In that case, it was pogroms, which were massacres of Jews, giant massacres of Jews. And her parents were driven out basically from Russia and went to Indiana, where they discovered the Ku Klux Klan alive and well. And that was in the 1920s. That was something I learned preparing this book, was about the rise of the Ku Klux, or the growth of the Ku Klux Klan in the 20s. And I learned it was related to the development of the auto industry in that area. And it was because droves of African Americans were moving up from the South to that part of the country, and the Ku Klux Klan followed or grew. So a lot of different times of hatred of different races and peoples comes out in some of the stories, and you really get a taste of the times and of what's gone on at different times.
That was a common thread that I noticed as well through the decades, is that war and how it has affected families.
Right.
And you bring it right up into contemporary times and 9/11, and there's a young Syrian girl, our
right.
family, and
Syrian American.
And
she was born in Oregon. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So this is a book that is really talking about, I think, the common aspects of being a human, of being a young girl, but also inflects all the stories with this history that maybe we don't have more than a one-dimensional view of. And so it really brings a lot of our American history to light,
right.
too.
It's been called history in motion, and I really think, you know, that also is a way to think of it. It really is in motion when you read chapter by chapter, decade by decade, and every chapter starts off with a very short history that describes what was going on to set context for the bigger picture of that decade, but also things that pertain to young girls, like what was going on with school and medical things and foods and music as that came in. And following the short history, I included a series of pop culture highlights for each decade. That really, pop culture also didn't really exist early on, but it was that sort of thing that was of interest, the toys that were coming in.
And the names. And so now we know that.
And the top 10 girls' names
Suzanne,
for each decade.
We're both Suzannes. I think we now have old-fashioned names.
Exactly. And I always thought that Laura was Laura, Lisa. These were just names when I was growing up. I had no idea they were names that were popular at the time. They are not popular names of the 80s, 90s, or 2000s.
But Ashley is.
Madison and Zoe.
Yes.
Right. And
yes.
Gladys was in the 10s and the 20s.
Mildred. Mildred right. had a few good decades.
Mildred had a few good decades, but she's long gone now. Hannah's might be coming back.
Yes. Well, Suzanne Sherman, thanks so much for this lovely book, 100 Years in the Life of an American Girl. And so what can we look forward to?
We can look forward to the next book in the series, which I'm collecting stories for now. And the next book in the series will be 100 Years in the Life of a Teenage Girl, Coming of Age Stories. And the website for this book is www.100yearsinthelife.com. And on that website is a submission page where you can contact me, and I hope listeners will be some of those people that contact me, with interest in either submitting a story or being interviewed for a story and having me collect the story in their words for them. And everyone, whether they write it or talks to me for this story, has, of course, an opportunity to review the story, correct things, change them, whatever they like, and gives their final approval. So that's a great way to be part of the next book. And I'm collecting those stories now. So anytime over the next, let's say, 3 months is a great time to contact me.
Very good. That's 100yearsinthelife.com.
100yearsinthelife.com. Yes,
great.
And it's numeral 100.
What are some events that we have coming up that you might want to talk about?
The next event coming up is going to be a reading by not only me, but by several of the people featured in the book, which will be really fun to hear. It's going to be an event called Dine with Local Authors. It is on Mendocino Avenue at Gaia's Garden International Vegetarian Restaurant at 1899 Mendocino Avenue. And that is on Monday, December 14, from 6 to 8 p.m. So people are invited to come and have dinner and have a seat. And we have a small stage there, and we'll be doing a reading from the book by people from the 1920s, 30s, 40s, and a few others of the decades. So,
and a chance for you, our listeners, to talk with Suzanne and enjoy some of these stories that appear in 100 Years in the Life of an American Girl. Very good. Well, Suzanne, thanks for coming in today.
Thank you. Happy to be here.
That was my conversation with Suzanne Sherman. I'm Suzanne Lang, and you're listening to KRCB's A Novel Idea. We'll take a short break. Stay with us. We'll talk with Laura McHale Holland next. Suzanne Sherman will be appearing at Gaia's Garden on Mendocino Avenue in Santa Rosa, right next to the Last Record Store, on Monday, December 14th from 6 to 8, as part of their regular Dining with Authors series. Thank you.
Winner of a gold medal at the 2015 Next Generation Indie Awards, Sisters Born, Sisters Found, A Diversity of Voices on Sisterhood, is a collection of memoirs, essays, poems, and short stories simply about sisterhood. Laura McHale Holland is its editor, and Laura is the author of the award-winning memoir Reversible Skirt, and a volume of flash fiction, which has been called Arresting and Original, The Ice Cream Vendor's Song.
Laura McHale Holland, welcome.
Thank you. Thank you for inviting me.
This book you've just published as the editor, Sisters Born, Sisters Found, A Diversity of Voices on Sisterhood. And I want to talk about this book and the story of how it came to publication. But first, I'd like our listeners to know about some of your other work. And you have a memoir, Reversible Skirt, that won an award a couple of years ago, a Reader's Favorite Book Award. Tell us about that story and about bringing your memoir to publication and what maybe prompted you to write it.
Well, that was in the works for quite a long time. There was this voice inside of me that kept saying, you need to write this story. But I never fully committed to it until well into middle age. I would try, I would get started, I would get off to a really good start, and then maybe reach a problem or things would peter out, and I would back away from it and do some other projects. But it kept coming to mind, and I realized finally at some point that if I don't do this, it's going to always be there coming to mind. It was something I had to do to see what was next, you know, what was going to come after that.
So let's say that this is the story of your story of a childhood where you lost your mother and your father remarried. And then when your father died, you and your sisters were left with your stepmother. And just as I'm even recounting it in that vague of a way, it almost sounds like a fairy tale, but maybe with some problematic aspects to it. So it's something that was your life that you needed to work through, maybe through your memoir.
I certainly did need to work through it, but I think by the time I actually got around to writing the memoir, I had worked through much of the difficulties from my childhood. I mean, there's certain things that always stay with you. It's like, oh, okay, there's that again, you know, move past it or whatever. But I had gotten over quite a bit of that. So it wasn't for me like a real therapeutic thing. It was really more of a creative effort to tell a story that I felt really needed to be told because or this little person inside of me, the little girl that I used to be, is the one who really wanted this story told. And actually, that's hitting upon that child's voice one time. First, I finally made the commitment, okay, I'm going to do this project no matter what. And then about 2 weeks into it, this child's voice just came out of me onto the page and boom, you know, I wrote that first draft pretty quickly. And it's funny, like now this little girl is out in the world, sort of a different, it's me, but then it's not me. This little person in the book has a purpose because I think especially in the 50s when I was a young child and probably when I was a teenager, a preteen teenager in the 60s, people didn't talk about suicide. It was a shameful thing. And if you're in a family, if you're growing up in a family where you experience something like that and nobody has the tools to address it, you're just left there to figure out so many things on your own. And I think people who haven't experienced something like that don't have a clue what's going on with children. Now, I'm only one story. Every child is different. But I think this really helps people who might have to deal with something similar in their lives, might help them be more aware of the children and things they can't talk about, assumptions they might be making that aren't correct. So that's one vein, one important aspect, I feel, of the book. There's also the thing about abusive families. You can't always tell. And if children are high functioning, you might think, oh, things are great. There can't be any problem at home. And that really wasn't the case with us. And but through that experience, the wonderful thing was my sisters and I, when I was very small, didn't get along at all. We were born at 14-month intervals. We were crammed into a tiny room. I mean, it must have been 10 by 10. It was so small. And we fought all the time. And I never dreamed then, and I was the youngest, and it was a hostile family. So it's very hard for children when they're being abused, like the eldest, to then be very loving to the little sister. I mean, I don't know. It just certainly couldn't happen in our family. But just this wonderful thing happened where my sisters and I were able to come together and make a commitment to each other to help each other get through it. And it was really messy and rocky at first because we were stumbling around and we still had all these old feelings about things. But that was like the positive thing that came out of it. And they're my best friends now. We're very close.
It seems now, today, suicide is, it's among us. It's around. It's happening. It's very, very visible. And yet, it's something that still, I think, ruptures families. But maybe we do talk about it more. What's your sense of that?
I do think we talk about it more. But, oh, I think it certainly does rupture families. And just because maybe the society has moved forward some, like there's suicide hotlines, I don't think there was anything like that back in the 50s. I don't think there were many resources available for my mother. I know that she had a breakdown maybe when I was about a year and a half old. I don't know how long she was gone, but she was gone for a while, and then she came back and committed suicide shortly after she returned. I don't think she had many. I don't know where she was sent, what was done to her, anything, but there are so many more resources for people now. However, just because they're there doesn't mean people know about them. It doesn't mean that individual family members have the ability to reach for them. Or there's so many things you have to do in parenting children and moving on and making a living and just going forward. It's just so hard to address this huge, horrible thing that happened. And I think that's still true for people. But I think outside awareness, kindness, just the little things that people would do, little bits of awareness, they still stick with me now. They mean so much that somebody paused just to say something kind to me. It was so rare in my home life. Just things like that, that these are things that we can all do, no matter what we know about a situation. If we have a little hunch, just a pat on the shoulder and a kind word, it can last for years.
Where does the title Reversible Skirt come from?
Well, my father one time came through the door. It was always exciting, I think, for a lot of children whose fathers work all day. You know, they come home, it's just so exciting just to have him come through the door, rah, rah, run to the door, get your hug and everything. And one time he came home and he had boxes, one for each of the three of us. And this was very unusual. Every now and then he would go on a business trip, and that was rare too. He'd come back with a little snow globe or something. But to come back with this big box, it wasn't Christmas, it wasn't anybody's birthday. And he handed one to each of us. And there was an outfit in there that he had bought, one for each of us. And Kathy and Mary with my sisters each got a gray skirt with a nice sweater that went with it. But I got this beautiful reversible plaid skirt. I don't think they had a matching one in my size, you know, so that's what he picked out for me. And it was rare for us to get new clothes. It was rare for us to get good quality clothes. We had our mother's relatives who would send us a nice dress on our birthday and at Christmas every year, but our stepmother would put those away in a closet, and sometimes we'd never see them again. So this little skirt meant a lot to me, and I would wear it in fourth and fifth grades. I wore it three times a week. And even after he died, when I was in sixth grade, I kept wearing it and wearing it and wearing it until I think I was a freshman in high school. It was so short, I couldn't keep wearing it. But that's where that's from.
I'm talking with Laura McHale Holland on her memoir, Reversible Skirt. And how did you bring this book to publication? How did you get it published?
Well, at first, I was living in San Francisco and in Noe Valley, and it was a period of a downturn. I had been doing technical writing that came largely through my sister, Kathy, who lives down there, and so she's connected with a lot of tech companies. Things slowed down quite a bit. And so while I was not quite as busy as I was, I had the space to really work on the book and then think about, when I felt I had a good draft, how was I going to get it published? I reached out to agents, and I didn't find anybody who wanted to represent me. I did get some kind rejection letters, encouraging rejection letters back. And I also reached out to small publishing companies. And I got an acceptance from one of them. It was so exciting. It was Creative Arts Publishing. They had been in business since 1969. They had published some of the Beat Poets, and they had published the woman whose name I can't remember, but at the time she was the Poet Laureate of San Francisco. I thought, wow! And he wrote this letter that was just so beautiful, saying everything I would have ever wanted to hear about my book, you know, and why he wanted to publish it. But then he followed up with another letter about the terms, and he wanted me to pay $8,000 toward publishing costs, which is very unusual. This wasn't what the company had been doing, because a friend's husband had published a book through them the year before, and he wasn't asked to pay anything. And so I certainly didn't sign that contract. I didn't have $8,000 to spend, but it was so hard to, I mean, it was a good company. But I did some research, and I was able to find out through a lawyer who had some connections, he was involved in the arts, that the company was in serious financial trouble. So I just let that go, and a few weeks later, they went out of business. And all those writers, even some who had agreed to pay, others who hadn't, oh, they were in terrible shape and I was just so glad. Okay, so that was discouraging. But then I heard, well, sometimes if you win a contest, that will lead to publication. So I started looking on the internet for possible contests, and Rockaway Press had an international writing competition, and they had several categories. One of them was memoir. So I thought, okay, I'll send it off. And I won in the memoir category. It was so thrilling. I'm going to get published. I told everybody, oh boy, this is so happy. I signed a contract. But that publisher ran into some difficulties. The woman who runs the place is wonderful. She's great to interact with. She set up a little group in Yahoo where all the authors who were slated to be published could communicate with each other. It was supportive, great community. But she published maybe five books and then did nothing. And this went on, and I held on with that for 4 years because I didn't want to let go. And then I finally thought, well, I don't know how much longer this is going to go on, if she'll ever get around to publishing my book. So I parted ways with Rockaway. And then at that point, I had to make a decision. Am I going to go through this again? Am I going to start reaching out to agents? Am I going to reach out to little publishers? And then what's going to happen after that? And I thought, well, self-publishing is becoming more viable. There's less of a stigma associated with it. I'm getting older. I don't know how much time I have. And so I decided to go form my own company. I did some research and decided to go with Lightning Source. At that time, Ingram didn't have Ingram Spark. If you wanted to work with Lightning Source, you had to become a publisher, which I did. And it's been very good working with Lightning Source and having the distribution through Ingram. Although my first two books aren't returnable, so I don't think bookstores would be inclined to order it. But I did make Sisters Born, Sisters Found returnable.
Explain to me what that means, returnable.
Oh, okay.
You could return it to the publisher if
yes,
it doesn't sell?
Yes, yes. And that's a big risk for a little bitty publisher. And I haven't wanted to take it. But I felt like I should do that for this book because there are people all over the country and several people scattered around the world who have contributed to this book. They want to see it in bookstores where they live. And so I was willing to take the risk to have it be returnable so that stores will be more inclined to order it. Because sometimes, even though it's in the Ingram system, if it's not returnable, they won't order it, even if they could, you know.
Well, then let's move on to this book. So the publication of your memoir led to you becoming a publisher.
That's right.
And it seems like Sisters Born, Sisters Found has an interesting story as well. And as you just mentioned, it has stories from people all over the world, really. And so what was the genesis of this project?
Well, in 2011, when I had just published Reversible Skirt, I was thinking about ways I could market it. And I knew about Sisters Consignment Couture in Sonoma. And I thought, well, with a store name like that, Sisters must be important to the owner. So I just reached out to Chris Johnson. We met one morning at the little Sunflower Cafe there in Sonoma. And I gave her a copy of the book and said, I know you don't sell books. You're a consignment store. They're a wonderful store. They've got great stuff in there. But I thought maybe there was some way that we could do something with this book together in your store. And so she read the book. She liked the book. And we came upon the idea of doing readings there periodically at the store. So since 2011, I have been doing readings once or twice a year. And they've all gone so beautifully. It's a small place, so it's not a huge event. It's a really cozy environment. And just with that small group of people who've contributed, there was such diversity and such power and such enthusiasm for sharing our sister stories, either through memoir or short story or essay or poetry. The idea came to me, maybe I should do a collection of these writings. That would probably be a good idea. And Chris would go, So it was just one of those things that was there as a possible project, but I didn't, it took a little while for me to decide, yes, I really want to do this. I think it would be really good. I think it would create a very good book. And so initially, I thought it was going to just be this small thing, maybe similar to my second book, The Ice Cream Vendor Song, which is flash fiction. It was just a little project which was relatively easy to do. And I thought, well, okay, this collection will be a little more difficult because it won't be all my own work, so there'll be some folks to deal with and editing and all that. But I still thought, not a big deal. But I started reaching out to people on Facebook, and there was this enthusiastic response. I did send a lot of messages to people that I'm connected with. And, you know, for a long time I thought, well, Facebook, I'm just not sure. Initially, I got into Facebook because people involved with Redwood Writers, the local writing group that I belong to, said, oh, yes, if you've got a book, you have to be on Facebook. You know, that's how you promote your book. But I found really what it primarily did was connect me with old friends from far, you know, all the way back to grammar school, which is wonderful. I love that, being in touch with people from every part of my life. But in terms of actually promoting the book, I connected with lots of writers, but we're all wanting to promote our own work, and it really didn't do much of anything along those lines. But when it came to reaching out to people to contribute to this book, it was a huge benefit. I think that's the primary place where I did connect with folks. I did put one ad in Writer's Relief, too, so some submissions came in through there. And as they came in, I just got more and more enthusiastic, and I just had to grow with the project to the point where I realized I had offered people two copies of the paperback, at least one version of the ebook, plus a $10 honorarium. Although some folks who know me, they gave it back to me and they didn't accept it, which was very kind. But I realized along the way, well, one of the people who lives in Europe said, well, how come I can't get a copy? And I was thinking, well, that's awfully expensive to ship books around the world. But then I thought, well, that's not really fair. So I did fundraising through a site called PubSlush so that I would actually be able to print and post books to go around the world. And so that's part of the story. And
so you used social media to essentially solicit authors to participate, and then maybe you even had to curate a little bit. I mean, did you find yourself in a position of having to actually reject some authors?
Oh, yes. Yes.
Which was maybe an interesting position for you to be in.
Yes, it was. It was difficult. But I just was as kind as I could be. And I did consult with some other folks, so I attributed it to a committee of people, and it's unfortunate, but it does have to happen. There were some works that I felt really needed a lot of editing, but I felt like the perspective was one that I really valued and wanted to have in there, so I did work harder on some than others.
And tell us a little bit about maybe what you, one of the most surprising entries that appears in the anthology or surprised you?
I don't know if surprising is quite the word, but it's just so pleasing. Like Maria Dolores Victoria wrote this one called Lentil Soup that I just love. It's toward the beginning, and it talks about she and her sister and her sister's cooking and play cooking when they were really little, and how that evolved and affected their lives. And, you know, I don't want to say too much about it, but it was just so, so gorgeous. And the poem, the very last poem in the book by Anna Manwaring, Before I Forget, oh, it just devastates me in a good way. Every time I read it, it's just so moving. And
do you also have a piece in the book?
I do. I have a piece about visiting my sister Kathy when she was in the hospital in high school. She was working in theater and broke her back. So she was in the hospital for more than 2 months in her senior year of high school. And we actually had a lot of fun visiting her, Mary Ruth and I. So that's going to be in the sequel to Reversible Skirt that I will get back to working on sometime this year. I haven't, while I've been involved in the anthology, I haven't really done much with that.
So Sisters Born, Sisters Found has authors from all over the place, but also local authors from Sonoma County.
That's right.
Some names we're familiar with.
That's correct. That's right.
Laura, thanks so much for coming in and telling us about your work. Thanks so much, Laura.
Thank you, Suzanne. Thank you.
my conversation with Laura McHale Holland. Earlier in the broadcast, we spoke with Suzanne Sherman on her book, 100 Years in the Life of an American Girl. You can listen to this episode of A Novel Idea, along with a whole lot of other ones, at krcb.org. You can subscribe to our podcast or download the KRCB app and listen on your tablet or cell phone. This is a production of Lit Radio and KRCB Public Media. We have production assistance from Sean Knight and Mark Prell. I'm Suzanne Lang. Thanks for listening. It's a novel idea.